Welcome, subscribers. We are continuing with our discussion with Webster Griffin Tarplay. And like I mentioned during our regular show, I'd really like to get into now the area of the Venetians. And basically, I don't know where to begin here because I've got very sporadic bits of information here and there from different sources, and I'll imagine much of it is from Webster also. But to get things going here, let me first ask you here, how far back do we need to go to kind of begin to pick up a thread here and there? Maybe we can move on to, you know, who are the Venetians and what are their connection to the modern world today, Webster?
All right, I guess this is a tall order, but let's see what we can do. The Venetians, of course, claim that they were founded in those lagoons at the top of the Adriatic at the time that Attila the Hun went by, so maybe 450 A.D. or sometime like that at the end of the Roman Empire. That is probably a little bit fanciful, but there are pretty old colonies there in the Venetian lagoons, because once you got inside, it was easier to avoid some power approaching on the land. It's important to see the Venetians are certainly around, in the years after 800 A.D., and we know this because they take the side of the Byzantine Empire against successors of Charlemagne, right? The Franks. They take the side of the Byzantines against King Pepin. So this is the so-called Pax Nicephori, where the Venetians claim that they're not part of the Western world, but they're part of the Eastern or Byzantine Empire, and that's something that they continue to have this Oriental characteristic to them. I guess then they get as trade and cities revive in Italy in the 1100s and so forth. The Venetians are one of the main beneficiaries. It's important to remember that they always have a kind of a collectivist overtone. They always do have this this Byzantine thing that the economic life is significantly dominated by the state, although the private families are the main beneficiaries. I guess the Venetians get to be an important power with the Third Crusade a little bit after 1200, where they actually go and conquer Byzantium. They get a bunch of French feudal knights who are told that they're going to go conquer Jerusalem, but then they go and conquer Constantinople, which was not the idea, but which was the richest city in the Mediterranean area at the time. So the Venetians go and take that over and try to have the Latin Empire of the East, which doesn't last for too long. The Venetians build at the first part of this, they're just about always a naval power based in the lagoons only. In the 1300s and 1400s, they acquire a land empire in Italy, and as Machiavelli writes and others, Aeneas Silvius Piccolomini, Pope Pius II, observe in the 1400s and 1500s, they're trying really to conquer most of Italy, but they don't succeed. And in doing this, they're trying to use this method of geopolitics. That is, they're always trying to ally with the second strongest competitor against the strongest competitor, and therefore to eliminate the strongest competitor, and also to try to eliminate or weaken the one that they're allied with. It's not a good idea to be allied with the Venetians. And the key moment in all this then becomes the year 1509. It's almost completely forgotten by most people, but most historians even. But at the beginning of the modern era, and really the close of the Renaissance and the beginning of the modern era as we've known it, there's a world war in Europe, and it is called the War of the League of Cambrai. Does this ring a bell at all?
No, actually it don't.
Okay, so we're in 1509. It's the War of the League of Cambrai, and it is essentially an alliance of just about every European and Italian state against the Venetians, because the Venetians have antagonized all of them. It's something like what the British found in the Boer War around 1900. When they found themselves in trouble and everybody hated them, or indeed what the United States is finding today. We're having a League of Cambrai moment here right now, where they're basically everybody in the world turning against the United States based on this built-up resentment and antagonism.
Yeah.
In 1509, it was simply this. You've got the Pope, Julius II de Lerovere. You've got the Holy Roman Emperor Maximilian. You've got the King of France. You've got the King of Spain, Ferdinand. You even have the English for a while in a war against the Venetians. So they all gang up on the Venetians, along with many other Italian states, Milan and some of the smaller ones. So they're all ganging up on the Venetians, and we have this famous battle in Venetian history. It's the turning point, the Battle of Agnadello, May 1509, which is when the French army annihilates the Venetian army and basically conquers the entire land empire that the Venetians had built up over 200 years. As Machiavelli said, they lost in one day what it had taken them several hundred years to accumulate.
Huh.
And this is the part that then begins to become interesting for us, because that experience effectively ends the notion that Venice could be a great power based on a piece of northern Italy, which is what they'd been doing up to then.
Mm.
So at that point, they begin to think about a number of things. One is what I call metastasis. It's usually the process by which a cancer goes from one place to another inside the body, right? When it spreads, what the Venetians do is they begin to export their doctrine, their ideas, and their money, and their families. They begin to invest. They begin to look for places outside of Venice where this form of oligarchical domination that they're accustomed to could be continued, and they look at the French, and they create a Venetian party in France. They create a significant part of the Dutch, significant Venetian party in the Netherlands, above all in England and in Scotland. And ultimately, I would say, in the broadest historical sense, it's the Venetian help and sponsorship that allows the English to win out over their rivals and then become the dominant world empire of the last 300 years. It's the Venetian party of England. And this is not just me saying this. If you look at the novel Coningsby by Sir Benjamin Disraeli, Prime Minister of Britain many times during the 19th century, he essentially says that the Venetian system was exported, that the King of England is nothing but the Venetian Doge in disguise, that the English Constitution is a version of the Venetian one, and above all, it's the Whig Party. In other words, it's the party of the great Whig aristocrats, the aristocratic party of top, super-rich oligarchs who would like to have a Venetian system, and indeed from about, from 1688 until 1832, I guess, you can say that there was, with some exceptions, a Whig aristocratic system on the Venetian model among the British. Now, there are maybe two or three aspects of this stuff that we can point to.
Yeah.
One is the fact that the Venetians come on the scene as the great allies of the Protestants in the wars of religion.
Hmm.
That the Venetians have a structural hostility to the Vatican, because, of course, they regard the Vatican as a rival Italian state with whom they share a border. They don't like the super Catholic powers like the Austrians or the Bavarians or people like this. So they have a very strong anti-Catholic prejudice, and they therefore bet. Their bets are largely done on the side of the Protestants. This is a problem for some people, because I see a lot of things on the internet where people say, well, the real source of evil in the world today is the Jesuits or the Vatican.
Yeah.
And I regard this as absolutely fantastic, because if you look at this, this is not what governed the world. If the Spanish Empire had dominated the world over the past 300 years, then we might be able to say, yeah, the Pope and the Jesuits were the ones who benefited from this, but this is clearly not the case. That the Catholic powers, be it Spain or France, were on the losing end. So therefore, what dominated the world is obviously the British Empire. Anybody can see this. And what's the main influence on them? Well, it is indeed the Venetians. So it's a very big mistake to think that the Protestants are the good guys. And this is a tremendously deeply rooted prejudice that you see in the historiography of the 30 Years' War, right? Gustavus Adolphus and what he means for Central Europe and, you know, the role of Sweden as a great power. All of this is based on the idea that somehow the Protestants are the good guys and the Catholics are automatically the bad guys. In reality, it's much more complex. And there is no such thing as good guys and bad guys in that rather primitive way. I mean, that's a kind of a view of the world we might expect from George Bush and his primitive Manichaean outlook, but that's not the way the world actually works.
Yeah, yeah. And what is it that, you know, kind of unifies this group of folks basically as Venetians? I mean, is it the area, or is it, I mean, certain traits, you know, as a human race?
It's the idea that oligarchy should rule. If you look at human societies, you can classify them in many ways. You have some societies that are ruled by generals. Some societies are ruled by priests. Others by aristocrats, by bureaucrats, by demagogues, right? By, you know, super democratic demagogues.
Yeah, yeah.
But the Anglo-American system and the Venetian system before it is none of that, right? It's not any of the ones I just mentioned. It's bankers. It's financiers. And that is essentially the model that has conquered the world. If you look at the world today, if you go to Latin America, the notion of oligarchy is pervasive. In Russia, under the Yeltsin years, there was a ruling class who actually came forward and called themselves the oligarchs. They would say, "We oligarchs have decided that Yeltsin should get another term as president in 1996 or whatever it was." If you look at Europe, it's dominated by what? The European Central Bank, a completely oligarchical and Venetian-style institution. Here in the United States, think of Plato's definition of oligarchy. It's a government where the public offices are bought and sold, and the poor people have no voice in government. That's pretty much the U.S., pretty much the British.
Yeah.
It's pretty much every part of the world under financial globalization. The other thing that's important is this notion of geopolitics. From 1509 until about 1800, 1797, the Venetians are a very, well, they're at the beginning they're a little bit stronger, but they're getting weaker all the time. So they're a rich, weak state. They're a plum ripe for the taking. And the only way that they can survive is by geopolitics, meaning playing one power against another, creating conflicts among other powers, and saving themselves through the influence of the diplomats, right? The Venetians are the ones who invented diplomatic service, a foreign ministry, the constant presence of ambassadors, the fact that these ambassadors are writing everything down, sending it back to Venice. If you go to the State Archive of Venice today, it's one of the hugest archives in the world. It's just immense, and as Leopold von Ranke, the German historian of the 19th century, said, if you want to find out something about anything under the sun, go to the Venetian archive, and one of these ambassadors will have written something about it, which is going to give you a good starting point. So they're creating conflicts among other countries, as well as playing off those other countries against them. Now, they are generally neutral, but they're always fomenting wars against others.
So, Webster, is there any, according to yourself, any connection here to, you know, the kind of the revolutionary movements that have been spreading through, I guess, what could be termed more like, you know, secret societies and maybe even Freemasonry and so forth?
Well, I think the origin of modern Freemasonry is the Venetians. And this is where it comes from. It comes from the Venetians. You can go to Venice today and see some crumbling Masonic temples from the late 1600s, 1700s. So I would say it's from there. If you look at these institutions, the British basically get what they have from the Venetians in terms of Freemasonry. I think this is where it comes from. And this is constantly then, you know, if you look at somebody like Casanova, is officially a Venetian agent operating in France as a geopolitical agent, and what he's interested in doing is weakening the French to make sure that the British win out, but he's also interested in preparing the sort of Robespierre side of the French Revolution. I would say that's what Casanova is actually doing most of the time. In other words, the sex stories are an interesting facade, but what he's really doing is something political and therefore much more important. Now, let me just focus on two questions, which I hope to be able to illuminate in writing before too much more time goes by.
Yeah.
I have written these things up, and they are various places on the Internet, but two examples of the Venetian geopolitics. The first is the Protestant Reformation itself. During the course of this War of the League of Cambrai, 1509 to 1517, the Venetians are at death's door repeatedly. In other words, they have an army of 100,000 German Landsknechte comes down through the Brenner Pass and is camped out at Padua and is laying waste to the Venetian countryside, and they want to come and break into the city of Venice and destroy the place.
Mm.
There's another time when a Spanish army goes along the coast of the lagoon burning everything 2 or 3 years in a row. So the Venetians are in the most acute emergency you can imagine. And I think what they do at that point is they begin to say, how can we foment problems, rebellions, diversions way in the rear of our enemies?
Yeah.
For example, religious conflict in Germany. It's often forgotten that Luther and his theses of 1517 comes right in the middle of this world war.
Yeah.
right in the middle of the War of the League of Cambrai, or towards the end of it, but right in the middle of it, so to speak. And that what Luther is doing is something that lends itself very much to what the Venetians want, which is to create religious conflict in Germany.
Yeah.
They want to stir things up so the Germans will be fighting themselves instead of sending that huge army of 100,000 Landsknechte across the Alps into northern Italy, where they're going to destroy everything that the Venetians have. It's worth also indicating that the Venetian, their kind of, what can we say, knee-jerk reaction to a strategic crisis. We have one previous example. The War of Ferrara in 1482 is a point where all the Italian states, this is now the five, right? There are five, and four of them gang up. So it's Milan plus Florence plus the papacy plus Naples gang up on the Venetians, who are the fifth. And at that point, what happens? Well, they go into a, you know, emergency mode. They've got to, you know, get loans. They've got to defend themselves. They've got to do all sorts of things. They also try to get their diplomacy at work, trying to create divisions amongst the other four.
Yeah.
But the thing that they do is to fill the streets, fill the roads with apocalyptic preachers. And you can see some of this stuff is, it has a certain spontaneity to it. In other words, the notion that Venice could be destroyed, for some of them, is the end of the world. As Aeneas Silvius Piccolomini, Pope Pius II, wrote in his observations on all this, he would say, the Venetians worship the state. They're not Christians in the normal sense. They have the religion of the state.
Huh.
For them, the state, the government, is the god. And there's a famous Venetian proverb, mi son Venetian, poi son Christian. I'm a Venetian first and a Christian second. And I think this sums it up. So there's a certain spontaneous element, but there's also a certain secret intelligence aspect to this. So they fill the roads with the apocalyptic preachers, and lo and behold, before too long, we have the famous friar Savonarola showing up in Florence with a pro-Venetian platform. He says, let's reform the Florentine government to make it look like Venice. Let's copy the Venetians. Now, this is as unpopular as can be, and you wonder, why does he do this? Why does he say this? Well, the Savonarola family is a family with its roots in Venetian territory, in Padua in particular. There's the Savonarola Gate, right? Porta Savonarola.
Mm.
If I say Savonarola, does that ring a bell at all?
No, it don't. It doesn't.
No?
No.
I'm sorry, you've got to basically go back and look at this. Savonarola is famous for essentially an ascetic dictatorship. In other words, what he does is he wants to have the dictatorship of virtue. What he says is, let's take all the art treasures of the Renaissance, pile them up, and burn them.
Okay.
So this is the bonfire of the vanities. Ever hear this expression?
Because I was going to ask you regarding the Renaissance and so forth. But yeah, do continue.
The Venetians have no Renaissance. The Venetians have a Renaissance after the sack of Rome in 1527, when refugees come there. But they have no Renaissance really of their own. They have a kind of a fake pseudo-Renaissance based on these refugees that they have come in when the other places have been destroyed. Because that's what happens with these wars. You have the sack of Brescia, the sack of Florence, the sack of Milan, the sack of Rome. Pretty much all of them are rolled over by military operations, which lead to tremendous destruction and the end of the Renaissance. That's how the Renaissance ends. It ends in these wars, the Italian wars, starting with the War of the League of Cambrai. So it looks very much like Savonarola is somebody with a very strong link to Venice. He's always going to Venice. He says that's because that's where his Dominican province is located. So he's got to go check in with the superiors. But this is maybe not so convincing. So it looks like the Venetian strategy is, if you're in real trouble, you send out people who are preaching the end of the world, and it's time to prepare and repent for the end is near and dump civilization. So Savonarola is one example of this. I mean, he does it before Calvin does it in Geneva. He does the Reformation at the level of a city.
Yeah.
Is pretty much what he does. And then Luther. And then you look at Luther, and you find that the main protector of Luther is a guy called Spalatin, right? Georg Spalatinus.
Never heard.
He called this because he comes from the city of Spalt, southern Germany.
Yeah.
It's kind of almost a pun because Spalt means spalten, right? To divide, to split.
Ah, okay, yeah.
Kirchenspaltung, right? The split of the churches.
Yeah.
Is what he brings about. So we look at him, and we find that he's in touch with the Venetians through Aldus, through the famous Venetian publishing house, Aldus. And then we find that Spalatin is the disciple of a German humanist by the name of Mucianus Rufus of central Germany, of Erfurt and Göttingen and these areas.
Yeah.
And this guy, Mucianus Rufus, is somebody, when we read his Latin letters, he says, well, I've been in contact with the Venetian patricians. I talk to Venetian patricians wearing these big, heavy gold chains. So the idea that you get is that Luther, at the beginning of his career, is very much under the sponsorship of this guy, Spalatin, and that they're all part of this Venetian network. And it seems to suggest that the Protestant Reformation itself is a very important example of an intelligence operation.
Yeah,
in other words, that Luther is not a spontaneous phenomenon. He's not what he pretends to be, he seems to be. The other interesting thing is that if we know, you know anything about the history of Luther?
Not so much.
Swedish Lutheran, I would think you do.
Not so much, actually, but...
You know, the moment when Luther becomes a Lutheran is what's called in German das Turmerlebnis, the experience in the tower. And what Luther says is the time that I really come to my, definitive view of faith, right, that salvation is by faith alone and by grace alone, and but not by works.
Yeah.
And so forth. He says, this is when I was in this tower in the castle, and he's a monk, and he says, this is when I realized that Paul's letter to the Romans means that salvation is by faith alone, not by works at all, nothing you can do, only by faith. And it turns out that this particular experience is one that had been already had about 3-4 years earlier by Gasparo Contarini, who was the leading figure of the Venetian oligarchy at the time, on around Easter in the early teens, during the War of the League of Cambrai. But he has this mystical experience where he says, look, the way that we're saved is almost exclusively by by faith. He doesn't go quite as far as Luther, but we have an experience that has pretty much the same internal structural features as what Luther goes through. And then after that, there's absolutely no doubt that the Venetians become the main publishing center to support Luther. In other words, they support Luther by spreading the Lutheran message. Ultimately, the Venetians are not too happy with Luther because Lutheranism, because it relies on the princes, right, of the Holy Roman Empire, it leads to quietism. They don't do enough fighting. So later on, we get Calvin, who comes in with the idea that you really have to be a fighter.
Yeah.
The Venetians like that much better because this is what they expect Protestants
to do. So the thing here is to still, they created this split within the Catholic Church, correct?
Yeah, I think that would be my finding. In other words, I think you can make a very, very strong case. A lot of it is circumstantial evidence because a lot of the evidence has been destroyed by people who don't want, you know, the obvious stuff to come out.
Yeah.
But in terms of a political judgment, you'd have to say that Luther would seem to be an asset under the control of a Venetian network who is used by the Venetians, first of all, to destroy the influence of Erasmus of Rotterdam. They use him against Erasmus, and then to start the wars of religion, which is it is one of the ways in which the Venetians are able to survive. Because as a number of historians will tell you, von Ranke, again, is another one, the fact that the Venetians were able to survive at all from 1509 to 1797, when they're finally destroyed by Napoleon, it's inexplicable. How can they do this? This is a tremendous achievement, because they're increasingly weak, but they're also very rich. They'd expect somebody to come in and take them over.
Yeah, yeah.
This is not what happens. So the first reason is, well, why not? Because you're in the area of the wars of religion, and they managed to stay out of this. The second act of this that I would point to is the 30 Years' War. And, of course, now Sweden has got this key role in the 30 Years' War, but only really at the latter phase, right? You have to look at the beginning phase, and what you find is if you look at all of the people in Europe, say about 1600 or 1605, you'll see that one of the, well, it's not clear, we can't really make total generalizations about this, but it is clear that one of the leading groups that talks about wanting a general war, wanting a general European war of religion, is the group in Venice around a guy called Paolo Sarpi, S-A-R-P-I. So we've had Contarini, Gasparo Contarini, C-O-N-T-A-R-I-N-I.
Yeah.
In the period, or, you know, just, you know, from 1509 to 1535 or so.
Yeah.
And now we're talking about 1600 to about 1625, when the main figure in the Venetian oligarchy is Sarpi. He's actually not a nobleman himself, not a patrician, but somebody who comes from a slightly lower class, but he's nevertheless able to be the dominant one.
Wow.
And you'll see that his approach to the whole thing is there has to be an apocalyptic general war between a Protestant coalition, hopefully including France, on the one side, and the Catholic powers. He calls them the Dia Catholicon, the Spanish, the Papacy, and the Austrians. I think you can make a very strong case that Sarpi and his group, it's a very widespread European network. It's a radical pro-Protestant network that exists in any number of European countries, that they are instrumental in setting the stage and unleashing the 30 Years' War. In other words, it traditionally starts with the defenestration of Prague, right, the events in Prague in May of 1618, but it has a much longer gestation period. In other words, it's a preparatory period that starts really about 1605, 1606, about 400 years ago right now. You're getting into this process of development that leads to the 30 Years' War.
Yeah.
And, of course, the Swedes with Gustavus Adolphus come in at a later point, right? They come in, you know, in about 1630. So there's a whole phase of a dozen or more years of actual war before the Swedish forces make it. You know, it's traditionally known as there's a Bohemian phase, and then there's a Danish phase, and then there's the Swedish phase, and then there's the Swedish and French phase. So it goes from 1618 to 1648. You know, the main result of this is that about one-third to one-half of everybody in Central Europe is simply killed.
Yeah, yeah.
And it also leaves Sweden exhausted.
Yeah.
So Sweden is a great power for a certain brief period of time.
It is.
Based on the victories of Gustavus Adolphus before he gets killed. But then it turns out not to have been a good thing for Sweden anyway.
Hmm.
The result of this is, from the Venetian point of view, is that they are able to survive at a time when nobody would have expected them to be able to survive. So if you think about this, what's the comparison? The comparison is the U.S. and the British today are really pretty much in the same situation as the Venetians then.
Yeah.
That these are dying, it's a dying empire, and what they want to do is to use geopolitical tools and, above all, the manipulation of religion. See, this is an interesting thing.
Yeah.
The Venetians subscribe to the Byzantine theory of religion.
Yeah.
And the Byzantine Empire approach to religion is simply religion serves the state. Religion is a branch of state activity.
Yeah.
Which, if you think about the Western world, that's not the case. Right? In Byzantium, you have the emperor, who's a god, and the patriarch is his servant. Right?
Mm.
He's just an official of the godlike emperor. In the West, different, because the pope is one guy, and the emperor or the king is a totally different person, and they fight.
Yeah.
So there's a religious sphere, and there's a state sphere. The Venetians say, no. Religion belongs to the state.
Mm.
So the neocons today, I would say, are similar to the Venetians of the 1500s and 1600s, because what the neocons are really saying is, first of all, we're going to try to defend the existence of our empire through increasingly adventurous and reckless geopolitics.
So this,
we're going to do crazy things, and we're going to use religion as a tool of creating these conflicts.
So this is a philosophy that they exported basically from the start, and now we can have we might be having folks in power then that are studying this philosophy and maybe know how to go about to basically survive through this period.
Well, I think the people you have today, of course, they're subscribers to a very crude, simplified, primitive version of the whole thing. Which is to create conflicts, artificial conflicts, and to use them to maintain power. If you look at the neocons, some people say the neocons are students of Hegel.
I don't
see any evidence that Hegel has really much influence in Britain or the United States at all. But what I do see is that they have understood the Venetian system, which is simply geopolitics. In other words, ally with one group against another. In other words, a simple example would be the U.S. and the British are obviously trying to use India against China, against the Arab world, and so forth.
Yeah.
And they against Iran and against Pakistan. So they would like India to be cannon fodder and an asset, an expendable asset in this geopolitical project that they have. So that would be an example of geopolitics, right?
Yeah,
U.S.
Yeah.
nuclear deal with India would be basically saying, let's use India as an expendable pawn against these other enemies. The U.S. would like to use Europe, obviously. If you look at Hillary Clinton, Hillary Clinton says that she will attack Iran faster than Bush, better than Bush. Hillary says, I can get you European troops and European money
that
Bush can't get you. So Europe would be used as a tool.
Yeah.
So if you succumb to this 9/11 mentality, you're soon going to find yourself attacking Iran.
Huh. I mean, I got to ask you, Webster, I mean, what's your take here? Where do you think that we'll end up here in a couple of years, basically, down the road, so to speak?
I would say that the great imperative now is, of course, 9/11 truth. In other words, the official myth has got to be demolished. And we don't have time to go through all of the ways that this is being done.
But no.
We've had a lot of breakthroughs of the 9/11 truth movement into cable television over the past 3, 4, 5 months. You've got this movie Loose Change, which is going around the world and impacting, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people.
Yeah, I mean, it even recently, it even was on a show here in Sweden on the main, the state news channel.
That's what is tremendously valuable.
Yeah.
Obviously, it doesn't come to any really conclusive findings, but it does plant doubt. In other words,
exactly.
It shows people that the official version cannot be true, and I think that's already a great deal.
Yeah.
So the goal has to be to try to bring about the collapse of the official version of 9/11 as soon as possible, because we're now operating under the Cheney Doctrine. Cheney has basically said about a year ago behind the scenes that it's time to prepare for a nuclear attack on Iran, which will come in the wake of a nuclear new 9/11 or a new Gulf of Tonkin, and that will then be the pretext for this attack. Now, as far as we can see, the next window of opportunity for this, and of course we've been lurching along the edge of the abyss here. Right? We're constant for the past 2 years or so. We've been going from war emergency to war emergency. Really, as long as you've got Bush Cheney in power, and as long as the invisible government and the September criminals are still in power as they are, you're going to have the danger of this next phase, the wider war involving Iran.
Yeah.
The really dangerous time seems to be from about the 18th of October until about the 25th of October.
Oh, really?
That you've got the arrival of the Eisenhower aircraft carrier battle group in the Arabian Sea, Persian Gulf area. You've already got the Enterprise battle group there, so you'll have two carrier battle groups. One is allegedly replacing the other, but as long as they're both there, they're both there. So that could cover the build-up for an attack.
So they
seem to be taking with them minesweepers and other kinds of ships that would be useful for a war against Iran
in the
Persian Gulf, in the Straits of Hormuz. And we've had a tremendous mobilization of people on the internet trying to point to this obvious war danger.
The
October surprise could turn out to be Cheney's attack on Iran. He obviously would need to have a synthetic terrorism event to cover it.
Yeah.
And the other thing is the other thing you have to be aware of, strangely enough, in this is the phases of the moon. The U.S. always likes to attack when there's no moon, the new moon.
New moon, okay.
In the dark of the moon.
Yeah.
So
the
dark of the moon, I believe you can check it, it's the 22nd of October. So the Eisenhower battle group arrives on the 21st, and there's no moon on the 22nd. And this then means that this is an important time. And if you look at the website falseflagnews.com, I recommend it, you'll find a compendium of just about every U.S. military drill exercise and so forth that's going on. And you can see that there's a very big concentration in this period of the second half of October, beginning of November, because you know that the Republicans are very much in danger of losing control of the House of Representatives and or the United States Senate.
Yeah,
if that happens, even though the Democratic Party is very rotten, the Democrats would be forced to mount some kind of a investigation oversight of the many, many crimes of the Bush administration. Remember that from January, from about 2002 until today, we've had one-party rule in this country.
Yeah.
The Democrats have not been able to control anything. If the Democrats do control something, they're probably going to start having hearings, investigations.
Mm.
This could easily turn up things that are impeachable, and at that point we might have an attempt to impeach Bush, even though this is not what the Democratic leaders intend to do. The Democratic leaders intend to sell out.
Yeah, yeah.
But the Republicans, and of course it's not really the Republicans, but it's the invisible government, would rather not have divided government again. I think the average person in the world would be much better served by divided government. Let the Democrats, whatever they are, take over the House and or the Senate and let them do something to show that they exist and, you know, somehow fight Bush, investigate Bush, put Bush on the spot.
Yeah.
But the invisible government, I think, would not like that. So there's a certain sense that if they're going to do this next false flag terrorism vis-a-vis Iran, they may want to do it before this election.
Yeah.
And the election is on November 7th, just so people know when that is.
Okay. Well, I got to ask you, because you bring this up, the midterm election here, because I read an article recently from Paul Joseph Watson over at PrismPlanet.com. And he mentioned the you know, the recent the Cessna plane with the baseball star. You heard about this diving into the
This was widely reported.
Yeah, I mean, what? Kevin, got any idea about this? I mean, is it an accident or is it something, you know? To
I have no idea, and I don't. It's maybe not always possible to read a whole lot into every little
event
that goes by.
No.
But I think the overall pattern is clear that, you know, you've got this military buildup in the Gulf. You've got the fact that the U.S. and the British are losing in Afghanistan. They're losing in Iraq.
Mm.
The Israelis have been defeated in Lebanon. And there's a great hysteria. There's a kind of a Twilight of the Gods, you know, Berlin 1945 mentality among the neocons. A lot of the neocons are facing criminal indictment for various things that they've done. And there's a great desire to have a flight forward. And for the neocons, whenever they get into trouble of any kind, the only answer is war. they're you know, known as one-trick ponies. They're Johnny One Note, and the One Note is always send other people's children to die in useless, needless, and futile wars, and that seems to be what's going on behind the scenes. So I don't know any particular story about this plane.
No.
The one thing I also have to point to, there's one hopeful sign, which is we have it's been common knowledge for some decades that there's a homosexual cabal of Republicans who have dominated the House of Representatives.
Yeah.
Members of the House and also their aides, and that this has now come to the fore again in the Foley scandal.
Yeah.
What people may not know, and I urge you to go and look at Wayne Madsen report. About this. That's a very good website. Wayne is doing a fine job on this stuff.
Yeah.
What he will tell you there is that the Speaker of the House, Dennis Hastert, is himself a homosexual who goes on sex tourism to Southeast Asia with the very corrupt lobbyist Abramoff, who's now in jail, and that Hastert has a live-in homosexual lover in his townhouse on Capitol Hill, and that this is then connected to Jeb Bush and the guy who's supposed to succeed Jeb Bush as the governor of California, a guy called Crist, and also it's connected to Senator Allen, of Virginia, who is running for re-election and is one of the Democrats, one of the Republicans who may be defeated. So we've had this. If you read, go online to Tarpley.net and look in my Bush biography. There's a chapter there called Omaha, and if you look in the Omaha chapter, you'll see that there are stories of pedophilia, child molestation, child abuse involving Republican officials in particular. Going back 20 years or more, there was this thing called the Craig Spence Ring, which was a group of underage homosexual call boys, gigolos, who were taken on a midnight tour of the White House during the term of Bush the Elder in 1989, when they stole pieces of china and pieces of silverware and things like this. Anyway, there was already then this pedophile child molestation ring infesting the White House, and it's thought that this is an aspect of the liberal Republican faction, which is, after all, what Bush represents. In other words, internationalist bankers, because that's who he is.
And this was the story that first, you know, got mainstream attention from the article. Was it the Washington Times who had a big front page article about the
yes, right.
This.
That's the summer of 1989. Again, you go to my chapter Omaha in the Bush biography online. You find it all there because this is somehow an important part of this ruling machine. They are financiers. Again, I would say they go back to 1895. They go back to the moment when J.P. Morgan and his British backers, as a banking power, was able to show that J.P. Morgan was stronger than the United States government under President Grover Cleveland at the time in a crisis of the dollar and the U.S. gold stocks. Then we had the blowing up of the Maine and Havana Harbor in 1898 to found the empire.
Yeah.
We had the assassination of William McKinley, who was an old conservative Republican, and his replacement with Theodore Roosevelt, who was the beginning of the modern liberal Republicans, who had a lot of these same psychological problems that we see today among these child molesters, I would say.
Yeah.
Then you get, you know, the Federal Reserve, the FBI. Woodrow Wilson is another puppet of the House of Morgan.
Huh.
And with Woodrow Wilson, you get the U.S. coming into World War I on the side of the British. So the empire is founded. These are the same circles that attempted to kill Franklin D. Roosevelt in 1933. They tried to organize a fascist march on Washington, also in 1933, to stop Roosevelt from carrying out the 100 days of the New Deal.
Yeah.
And that's then what you see in the post-war with the things that I'm telling you about, the you know, the various things from the Gulf of Tonkin, the Bay of Pigs, the Kennedy assassination, Vietnam, all the way up to 9/11. There's a continuity going back, I would say, to the mid-1890s in terms of this financier faction based in Wall Street, leaning on the city of London.
Yeah.
And this is what dominates the U.S., and this is what brings you these imperial plans.
Well, I got to ask you, I mean, what is this? Do you have an idea of this, what this is about? You know, the pedophile thing. I mean, is this kind of some kind of, you know, psychological, basically, disease that is spreading within this group? Do you got any take on this? I mean, how come so many are involved in this up at the top?
Well, it's just an empirical phenomenon. And in some ways, it goes back to the Venetians also.
Hmm.
In this sense, the Venetians were always obsessed with not dividing the family fortune among three or four boys. So they would basically have only one son in the family would be allowed to get married and have children.
Mm-hmm.
And the others would either become priests, join the army, go to houses of prostitution, or become a homosexual. So there's a strong homosexual element in Venetian culture, which the British have pretty obviously absorbed, and which you now find. It seems to go together with banking somehow.
Strange.
In a sense.
Huh. Oh my God. I mean, oh, okay. That, I mean, there we go. I mean,
but I think it's a legitimate issue. In other words, what these guys do, you know, if they were just private citizens, this would be nobody's business.
No.
But it is a matter of public interest. In other words, if there were a cabal of, I don't know, vegetarians or science fiction addicts who had taken over the House of Representatives, the public would have a legitimate right to know that.
Yeah, of course.
In this case, it happens to be a cabal of homosexuals, and in some cases, it's a cabal of child molesters. These don't necessarily go together, but in this case, it looks like there is some overlap.
Yeah, of course.
So it's a cabal of child molesters and pedophiles who seem to be ensconced in the leadership position of the House of Representatives. And again, with Hastert, we know that he's got Scott Palmer, the live-in lover. This has been in the Washington Post now in the past week. And he seems, as Wayne Madsen reports, he seems to have gone on sex tourism to Southeast Asia, and God knows what that might imply. So
yeah,
I think the critical question right now is, as long as it's Foley, it's one thing. But as soon as it becomes Hastert as an active participant in these activities, then it becomes much, much more serious.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you're aware of this, but the peculiarity of the United States is that you've got these Republicans who rely for their support to a large degree on Christian fundamentalists who have a extremely puritanical approach to life in general, where they say that, you know, no sex outside of marriage can be allowed, that homosexuality is bad, that adultery is bad, that marriage is the model, it's all got to be according to this model. So they feel very strongly about this, and yet their votes are being used as a commodity by this cabal that we've talked about,
exactly.
who obviously have values that are completely the opposite of the people that are keeping them in power.
Yeah.
So if the Christian fundamentalist realizes, oh my heavens, my is being used for something that I disapprove of very violently, then that has the potential to blow apart the Republican Party.
Exactly. And that's why this is important. And Webster, I got to tell you, I mean, I got like three pages of notes here, you know, with dates and names. And I mean, your research is amazing. And I mean, we got about, I think we covered an amazing amount of information today. And I just want to leave, you know, kind of the floor open for you in the last few minutes here. I mean, tell us again about how to get your books or anything you want to, basically.
Yeah, I mean, my book, the 9/11 Synthetic Terror Made in USA, The Unauthorized Biography of George Bush, you can get these at Amazon.com. You can, if you're interested in looking at the Bush biography, that is now online, has been for 10 years as of this month. That's at tarpley.net. I urge people to look ahead. The one thing that we have to do, the great unfinished business of the 9/11 Truth Movement, is to bring together an independent international truth commission. People may remember the Russell-Sartre Vietnam Tribunal. You should remember it because it met in Sweden and in Denmark in 1966 to 1967. And this was a jury of very famous international people, sort of a Nobel Prize caliber. It had Lázaro Cárdenas, the former president of Mexico. It had famous writers, famous humanitarians, scientists, statesmen, politicians, Simone de Beauvoir, all kinds of very distinguished people were on the actual jury, right, the commission itself, and they heard presentations about U.S. war crimes in Vietnam, and this essentially destroyed the credibility of the Vietnam War in the eyes of world public opinion. And what we need right now is a similar commission, truth commission, I would say, internationally organized, that would meet, have that same caliber of person on the commission, and then hear presentations from people like me about the various, it's about 6 or 8 or 10 critical aspects of 9/11, where the official version is the weakest and where it's important to put forward a version of what actually happened. Jimmy Walter, the very famous political philanthropist, has been to Venezuela. The government of Hugo Chavez of Venezuela has expressed great interest in this idea. President Chavez has been the most outspoken head of state in attacking the official version, right, saying Bush, you know, may be implicated in blowing up these buildings. That's certainly the closest thing to 9/11 truth that the world has heard from somebody of that level. We've got Mahathir Mohamad, probably the most intelligent Islamic statesman in the world, who's also interested in the idea. I know, just personally, I was in Europe just now for the 5th anniversary. We had a meeting in Berlin of the German Netzwerk, the 9/11 Truth Network, with Andreas von Bülow, Gerhard Wisniewski, Matthias Bruckers. They're in favor of the International Truth Commission. I was in Ireland with Morgan Stack. The Irish group is very much on board. The British group is very much on board. I also was, I appeared at a lecture in southern Germany in one of the suburbs of Basel, Switzerland, on the 10th of September, about 160 people there. But that group is also in favor of the Independent International Truth Commission. And I also took part in what I think was the largest of the 9/11 events anywhere in the world for the 5th anniversary, was the Bologna Conference, which was about 700 people, with Giulietto Chiesa, the member of the European Parliament, who's taken up 9/11 and brought that into the Brussels European Parliament. He's actively organizing for the Independent Truth Commission, and my friend Maurizio Blondet, who has written the main Italian book on the subject. So you've got this tremendous international constellation of forces who are now coming together around the idea of an independent international truth commission, modeled pretty much on the Brussels on the Russell Tribunal of the Vietnam era, and that this has to be done again sometime in the very, very near future. And I would hope to do it on a true international basis with all the main elements of humanity represented. In other words, you're gonna need, you know, people from Russia, China, India, Black Africa, Latin America, the Middle East, Israel. You're going to need, you know, people from all over the world to come to an authoritative verdict that the official U.S. government version is a tissue of lies, and then maybe to advance some ideas about what actually happened.
Fantastic. I mean,
so
that's...
I urge everybody. That's something that everybody in the world can contribute to and take part in, and I hope people in your listening area will do that. Because in Scandinavia, as I say, they were absolutely critical the first time around, and they may be again this time.
Yeah. I mean, that's very good news. And I mean, again, I mean, let us know if you want to, you know, talk to us again, and we certainly want to let you on air any time here. So, I mean, I want to thank you so much for coming on, Webster. This has been an amazing interview, so thank you very much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Been listening to Red Ice Creations Radio. Thank you for being a subscriber. Your support keeps RedIceCreations.com alive. Until next time, take care.